We're privileged today to have with us Evangelist Will Rice and his wife, Senna. Had a good opportunity to spend time with them last night at the banquet, and he delivered a tremendous message, and we look forward to what the Lord has laid upon his heart. I shared with the young people last night, I said, it's wonderful to have a rich heritage behind you. He's Will Rice the Fourth. By the way, that's Will with one L. So he actually has three letters in his. He had to be different from the rest. But he has a rich heritage. I told the young people, I said, my mom read Dr. Bill Rice's materials, and I was on the receiving end of what she had learned. One of the books that she gave me when I got married was Love 'Em, Lick 'Em, and Learn 'Em. And she said, this is for when you have kids. So I put them on the receiving end of the same things that we had learned. But I know that Brother Rice knows and appreciates the heritage that he's been given. And I'm so thankful that he loves the Lord and wants to do what's right. We had a good opportunity to talk last night, and he wants to carry forth the Word of God and be faithful in that role. And so we're so glad that he and his wife were able to come this weekend. And Brother Will, would you come and share with us what God has laid on your heart?
Thank you, sir. Thank you. All right, well, howdy and good morning. We are in 1 Samuel 27. Would you turn there with me, please? 1 Samuel 27 is our text and our authority this morning. We're mighty glad to be with you. It's an honor to be with these seniors and their families and the faculty and you. And maybe you are a couple of those things as well, but we're glad to be with you. Sina, my wife, and I, we have three children. How old do you think our oldest child is?
13.
13, you're very close. Lauren is 16, just turned 16 last week. A month ago. See, when you get old, time just flies. I mean, you know, it used to be a week. Now, when you're an old guy like me, it's a month. So Lauren is 16. Wilson is 12, almost 13. And Weston is 9, going on 25. And they are with their grandparents. And so we've had, let me tell you, I've enjoyed the privilege of being here and preaching already. But we've just enjoyed getting away for a couple days. That's been great as well, and you all have been part of our weekend getaway, so thank you for that. We're glad for that. My grandparents started the Bill Rice Ranch 60 years ago out of a burden to reach their own deaf daughter for Christ. Nobody in those days was reaching deaf people for the Lord Jesus. One day they were driving down the road, and my grandfather was complaining, and he said, there are millions of deaf, and nobody's doing anything to reach them. My granddad, Tall Daddy, is in heaven. My grandmother's 98 and very feisty. And she looked, they were driving down the road in the Hudson, and grandmother looked over at him and she said, don't you know who's going to work with the deaf? They'd had this conversation before. And my granddad looked back and said, no, I don't. She said, well, I do. He said, well, I wish you'd tell me. She said, you are, and I'm going to help you. And my granddad protested, Princess, good night. I'm nobody. I don't have any money. I don't know how to work with deaf people. And she said, when you preach on the widow's oil, there are two similar stories you might recall about widows, both in the books of Kings, who had nothing, but when they obeyed God, God multiplied what they had. And she said, when you preach on the widow's oil, you always tell other people that what you have is enough to do what God wants you to do. And so the title and the tenor of that message is, what you have is enough, and it is. And so she said, when you preach to others, you always tell them what you have is enough. And my granddad used to say ever after, you know, preachers, the worst thing in the world is when your wife preaches your own sermon back to you. But that's what it took. They were in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, at that time a little town, it's not anymore. And I had a two-week area-wide crusade in a little church that built a 900-seat auditorium because they were growing and because of this crusade. It now houses the Sword of the Lord Publishers, which came in 64. But at any rate, they were in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. They told people they had a burden to start a ranch because my granddad, that's what he knew. His dad was a one-term Texas state senator and a cowboy by profession. My granddad grew up on a ranch. That's what they knew. And so they wanted to start a ranch where deaf young people could come free of charge, swim, hike, ride horses, meet other youngsters that knew their language and hear the Bible from people that loved them and knew them and understood them in a language they could comprehend. There was a man in the church, he said, I know just the spot. Took them 9 miles west to the old King Manny Ranch. And they bought the original 900 of 1,300 acres for $20 an acre in 1950. Moved into a little two-room block cabin, still at the ranch, oldest building around, called Trails Inn. And four kids, a dog, and a two-room block cabin. No running water, unless my dad or Pete would run and get it. And no restroom. Actually, it's pretty fancy now. Now it has a pitched roof. It used to be flat. Now it has a bathroom. Basically the size of this lectern here. My granddad, who was a romantic and a pioneer. You know what a pioneer is, don't you? He'd say, kids, isn't this great? He'd say, we're carving out a ranch in the wilderness while your friends, they're having normal, boring lives. Most of them live in a real house. Why we're living in a cabin? It's the most ill-constructed, no joke, building on the Bill Rice Ranch because it was built by three preachers. Bill, John, and Joe. They didn't know a lick about building, but they didn't have a choice, so they did. A little cinder block cabin. We're carving out a ranch on the wilderness, he said. And we're living like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. And I've heard my dad say, we were dumb enough to believe him. We thought it was great. We thought this was the life of Riley. And it was, because that's what God wanted them to do. Years and years later, Paul Levine was preaching to about 900 teenagers. And he was telling them what the Bill and Kathy had sacrificed to make this ranch possible. Why, he said, you'll never know how they suffered to make this ranch possible for you. Why, for years they suffered down there in Land's End. It's Trails End, but it was always the catalog to him. Down there in Land's End, they suffered so you could have this ranch. My dad was in college at the time. He was sitting on the platform that evening. And I've heard my dad say, I thought to myself, you mean we suffered? I thought we were living like Daniel Boone and Davy Crockett. I thought this was great. And he didn't know until he was 20 years old and some preacher told him how miserable it had been that they'd had a miserable time. But at any rate, so today we celebrate our 32nd year of camps in the Philippines where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of deaf have been saved. God has used what seemed like a tragedy to result in literally hundreds of churches establishing deaf ministries because of that work. This summer, we will have campers, both deaf and hearing, young and old, families and groups of young people from two groups from South Korea, again, most usually from California. We'll have groups from Arizona, from the Northeast, a church that's come for 25 years from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. It's about 900-mile drive from the Florida Keys. And I'm so honored even from here in Milton. I'm thrilled. Thank you for allowing us to serve your church by serving the young people this summer. And this is all because of God's using tragedy to begin something that He had in mind from the very beginning and brought something good from something that did not seem to be so in the early days. And so that's who we are. We're here, of course, privileged to be a part of your special day for graduation. I have learned that people don't come to graduations to hear the preacher. I've kind of discovered that. And I'm coming to graduation for the same reason. I'm coming to celebrate those that are graduating today. And congratulations to you, and God bless you. You've met my wife, Sena, S-E-N-A, four letters. And I'm the I'm the oddball. The only thing four in my name is Will Rice IV. I've ruined everything else. So at any rate, glad to be with you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for the privilege of being with you. 1 Samuel 27, right? We'll actually begin in verse 26. I just read this last week, and I'm in 2 Samuel now, and God put this in my heart some time ago, but I read this again last week. 1 Samuel 26, David was being hunted like a wild animal by Saul, and David finds Saul with his back to the ground and his eyelids closed. He was asleep. David could easily have killed Saul. God had told David that he would be the next king. And so some of his men even told him, hey, this is the day that God promised you. Now, let me tell you something. A good thing in the wrong way is not a good thing. And David was smart enough to know it. And so he did not kill Saul. To the contrary, he spared Saul's life, something Saul would not have done for him. And when it was all said and done, Saul, as he should have been, was shamed that he had sought David when David had spared him. And verse 24 says this, "And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes," David says to Saul, "I spared you just as I have, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord, and let him," that is God, "deliver me," that is David, "out of all tribulation." Now stop just a moment. Now this is Sunday school. I know I'm a stranger, but we're friends, right? Okay. So, what was David's primary tribulation right now? There's a name for it. Let's say, who was David's primary tribulation at the moment? Saul. And so David's saying, look, Saul, I honored your life. I'm asking God to honor my life, despite all the tribulation, you in my life. That's what he says. Now look at verse 25. Then Saul said to David, "Blessed be thou, my son David. Thou shalt both do great things, and also shalt still prevail." So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Saul says, "Oh, David, you're right. I'm wrong. God bless you, son. You'll be a great man someday." Let me ask you something. That sounds pretty nice, doesn't it? Huh? What do you think you would have done if you'd been David and been on the receiving end of all that good salutation and benediction and opsis, mopsis, unum, sodium, sanctum, blessed be thou? What do you think? What do you think? What would you have done? Huh? It really doesn't matter because you don't have that chance. What matters is what David did. What did David do? Did David hang around? Chapter 27, verse 1. And David said in his heart, "I shall now perish." Why are you worried about this now? I mean, of all the times, a day goes when you should have worried, and now you should be fine. But David said, "Now shall I perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should speedily escape unto the land of the..." What's the next word there? Let me ask you a question. Who is David's enemy? Saul or the Philistines? You don't know, so you don't answer, and I don't blame you. And Saul shall despair of me to seek me anymore in any coast of Israel, so shall I escape out of the hand of... Where am I here? Out of his hand. Verse 4, "And it was told Saul that David was fled to Gath." Is that ironic or what? Who lived in Gath? Goliath of Gath. So he goes back to Gath. I mean, that's like the last... This tells you how bad it was with Saul, that David would have the moxie to go back to the very town where he was like, he was the hero back in Israel. What would that have made him in Gath? You think Goliath had any relatives? Like on his graduation day from giant school, do you think maybe he had some relatives that showed up? Hey, let me ask you something. How much fried chicken do you think it took to feed Goliath's family? Huh? See, Goliath, this was not an anomaly. This was a family of big people. All right? It wasn't like, you know, my dad was 5'7", my mom was 5 foot tall, and I'm 9.5 feet tall. No, no, no. Let me tell you something. This guy had brothers. They had big families. They lived a long time. All right? Big families and big people in the big families. I mean, a big family had a whole different complexion when everyone in the family was like 9 feet tall. Big family just meant one kid, but he's 9 feet tall. That's a big family, even with one kid. So David goes back to Gath, the very place in which his life was sought. Now, on the face of this entire story is interesting if you have any sense of curiosity, whatever. And unfortunately, the longer you've known the Lord and the more you've read Bible stories, the less curiosity we tend to have because you've never read this story for the first time. And that is a distinct disadvantage, I will tell you. Don't, if something odd appears in the Bible, don't think, there's something odd, maybe there's a contradiction. And keep reading. Figure it out. God is able to stand up the test of your questioning. I assure you. And if there's something odd, there's something good. And if you'll take the time to figure it out, you might be the first person you know that has. Not because you're brilliant, but just because you have a sense of curiosity. That's not bad. Now, I've said all that to say this. Have you ever found yourself on the wrong side of an issue because the bad guys were nice guys? Don't think so. Well, that's good. I wish I could say the same, but I'm constantly tempted. Have you ever found yourself on the wrong side of an issue because the good guys were clods? They had a right position, but a rotten attitude. And the bad guys were nice guys. Now, being nice doesn't make you good. Did you know that? It is amazing what I can put up with when people like me are like the ranch. And how little I can sustain when people don't care for me or don't care for the ranch, but they're good, godly people. I'm not saying Saul was a good, godly person. But you know, it's amazing. I have learned that everyone that loves God doesn't necessarily like me. It's hard to believe that, isn't it? I mean, in my mind, if they love God, how could they not just think I'm a grand guy? Well, guess what? There are some people that love God, don't care for me, perhaps. And in the large scheme of things, that is okay. I'm talking to somebody this morning, young or old, and both are relative terms. Are you young or are you old? Well, it depends on who you're sitting next to. That is true. It is true. Good night. You know, I'm like in the middle. I'm too old to be hip with teenagers, right? And I'm too young and stupid to, I mean, you're being gracious to listen to me this morning, but, you know, that's kind of where I am. Look, sometimes personality trumps principle. What do I mean by that? I mean that a man's personality or a woman's personality is more important than what they believe or what they say. A la the debates. You do know, of course, that at one time, most notably in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which was a way of doing things, a candidate would stake his position for an hour, upon which the rival would rebut it for 30 minutes and then state his position for an hour. Nobody here, I don't care how gray your hair, has the patience to put up with that anymore. We are people with a short attention span, even the wisest of us. Today we have an hour debate, and the commentators are talking about delivery and personality and zingers and sense of humor. And let's face it, candidates always wear boring ties, never a pattern among them, right? If it is, you can't pick it up on CNN. It just doesn't even come across the TV waves. It's either a red tie or blue tie and more blue tie. Quite boring, right? But we'll talk about who had the prettier tie. I'm talking about personality trumping principle. Sometimes personality misrepresents principle. That is, someone who represents the truth, but because of lack of integrity or lack of love or both, misrepresents the truth they are to represent. Phillips Brooks famously said that preaching is truth through personality. I think that's a pretty good definition. I think there's some truth to that. I remember talking to a man not too long ago who told me of a preacher who had sadly disgraced himself by being untrue to his wife and untrue to his ministry and untrue to his church. And he heard this man preach after that had happened. And this man's commentary to me was, "But he still preached with power." Now, friend, you hear me and you hear me well. No, he did not. He may have preached with fervor, and he may have preached with vim and vigor and great personality, but he did not preach with the power of God. So sometimes our personality can trump principle. Sometimes personality misrepresents principle. My question to you this morning is, must the truth die one death or another? Are those the only two choices we have? Someone being nice but wrong and trumping the truth, or someone being a clod and holding the truth and so souring good people to a good truth by bad actions? Are those the only two options we have this morning? Emphatically not. So I would just tell you briefly, and this will be brief, that there's a lesson for us this morning, and it is very simply this. Your life should clearly communicate the truth. Your life, my life, teenager, seniors, juniors, sophomore, freshman, mom, dad, single, grandparents, your life should clearly communicate the truth. So the question is, what does that mean for the people in this room? And I will tell you that this story has a word for each of us. All right, quickly. First of all, a word to the seasoned. All right? I will tell you, seasoned is relative. If you're a senior, there's a school full of young people that think you hung the moon. They think you've arrived. And you may know better. I hope you do. But you're seasoned. And I'm talking to people that are wise and gray-haired this morning, but there are people that, because of their position or their knowledge, are senior to you in some respect. You understand what I'm saying? So all this applies to everyone, but some may be more specifically than others. A word to the season, and that is this. Do not turn good people away with bad actions. Do not turn good people away with bad actions. Abuse of authority and influence will do it. That is why, in chapter 26, verse 18, David asks Saul, "Why doth my Lord thus pursue after his servant? For what have I done? Or what evil is in mine hand?" David says, "Saul, why are you pursuing me? I'm your servant." Now, let me tell you something. How many gods did Saul serve? Not a trick question. This is not a cute answer. How many? You can argue whether he served him or not, but how many gods did Saul serve? One. That makes him a monotheist. Okay? Means he served one God. All right? Who was that God? Ultimately himself, I agree. But as to the God he represented to the Philistines, to the Amalekites, and yes, to David, who was the one God, superficially, let's say, that he served? Jehovah, that's exactly right. So he was a monotheist. Okay? What was Saul's race? He was Jewish. He was part of God's chosen special people. Here's a monotheist Jewish man. No, not Jewish man. Jewish king. He ruled these people. Now, so what I'm saying is that Saul represented God Jehovah. He was a monotheist, he was Jewish, he was a king, but he spent Israel's money, he exhausted Israel's army, and he soured Israel's citizens. In short, he misrepresented the truth. And God pity the person that does that. Why? Because you have a whole generation of young people that are turned off from God's truth by your actions if they do not represent God well and accurately. See, here's the trick. You're right. I think Saul was Saul's God. But people didn't know that, because you know who Saul sacrificed to? Willfully, he did so, but he sacrificed to God Jehovah. That's a problem. He would have done a lot less damage to Israel and to Jehovah's name if he had been the pagan in nationality that he was in heart. And so I'm telling you, if you call yourself an independent Bible believer and you don't live well, you're inconsistent, you're cranky, you're selfish, let me be kind, I'm a guess, this is right off the bat, isn't it? You sin against God. You say, "Well, I take a stand and I'm Orthodox." Yes, and I hope you understand this in context. It's a shame that you do, because you become a straw man for people that don't love the truth and would love to make you the representative of the truth that is being so misrepresented. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's what Saul did. Look, let me give you a couple applications quickly here. Look, I'm talking about me, and by application, all of us. I need to be a help. I need to be a blessing at church. Let me just read this to you in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 23. Paul is speaking. Paul was a preacher. Paul was an apostle. Paul had authority given him by God. And he says, "Moreover, I call God for a record upon my soul, that to spare you, I came not as yet unto Corinth." So part of his decisions were based not upon his rights, but upon their blessing. And then he says, "Not for that we have dominion over your faith, but are helpers of your joy. For by faith ye stand. Paul says, look, I'm not ruling your faith. I'm helping your joy. And you know what? That ought to be my attitude as a preacher of the gospel. I go home later this evening. We have almost 100 young people just on summer staff alone coming to the ranch. And I'm responsible in some respects for them. Let me tell you something. I need to be sure that I do not shirk my responsibilities, but that I don't use any authority that God stewards to me like a club with which I beat people over the head. I want to be a helper of their joy, not a lord of their faith. So at church, I want to be a help. I want to be a blessing at home, and this is even more important. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4, the Bible's talking to parents, but he addresses fathers in particular, and he says, and ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up, literally nourish them up in the nurture, the child training, and the admonition of the Lord. So I need to be a blessing at church. I need to be a blessing at home. Can I tell you something? I remember the day I realized my dad was strict. I never knew it. And I've come to the conclusion that strict is more a matter of attitude, a function of attitude, than it is of action. Because dad wasn't strict. But if you looked up from the outside in, you'd say, oh yeah, you couldn't do that, you couldn't do that, you had to do this. Yeah, your dad was strict. No, I had more freedom, joy than 95% of the kids that had twice the freedoms I had. Here's how it went down. I was in college. I was walking to the parking garage one day with my best friend who had a car. I did not. It wasn't a conviction. I didn't have a car. It's probably a good thing I did not. And we were walking to the garage. I was 20 years old. We'd just gotten back from Christmas vacation, and I just felt, I was becoming an adult, and I was struck by the fact that my parents, who will always be parents, there was also a friendship there. And I told my friend, I really appreciate my parents. I think they really trust me. By the way, the question is not, don't you trust me? No, I don't even trust myself. The question is, don't you love me? And that's why you have guidelines, rules. And my friend, who never took an idle word without a fight, said, like what? I said, well, my parents trust me. I said, when I was home for Christmas, I got to drive to town all by myself. And the second that dog escaped the kennel, I couldn't get him back. And I realized how utterly, forgive me, dumb that sounded. And I started laughing, and he started laughing. We both just had a good time. Now, let me ask you a question. Were my parents generous because they let a 20-year-old drive to town? 20-year-old drive to town? Not necessarily, but I will tell you that I misrepresent my parents by telling you that story because it makes them sound as they sounded to me that day, like really strict parents. Well, guess what? They were, but they weren't. Now look, I wish we had time to park here, all right? Some of us need a push in the other direction, all right? I'm just going the way the text is pushing us, and that is don't turn good people away with bad actions. I've discovered I can be as hard as I need to be as if the people with whom I'm being hard know I love them. I wish we could talk about husbands and wives. Selfishness will turn others away from the truth. You know, Saul lacked sympathy. David had never been Saul. He'd never been king. But Saul had been David. In fact, he was the one man on the face of God's earth who could have understood how David felt, but he had no sympathy because he was stuck on himself. As our brother has said, Saul was Saul's God. Let me ask you a question. Do you hold the truth? Great. And if you don't, get with it. But do you hold the truth? Great. How are you holding it? So word to the season. Don't turn good people away with bad actions. Quickly, we'll take 5 minutes to talk about this. A word to the young. And that could be everybody here. The word to the young is don't react to wrong by rejecting what is right. Now, I don't mean to be unkind to David, but what was David doing going to Philistia? Who was his enemy? Saul or the Philistines? You know, this was not consistent. Now, We can sympathize. I've already done that for the last 15 minutes, why David might do this, but it didn't make it right. Just because you can understand what David did does not mean that what David did was right. Now, let me tell you something, friend. We are losing young people by the droves. Not because we don't have the truth, but because we don't have integrity, and we don't have love, and we don't have the courage to say the truth with love. And so I'd just say, if you're a young person, or for that matter, if you're not, don't react to wrong by rejecting what is right. Look, now David lacked integrity. Why do you think that the king of Gath thought that David was in Gath? Why did he think? You can read the story. I'm not going to take the time. Two reasons. What were they? Why did the king think that David was with him? Take a guess. It's okay. He had turned against Israel. That's exactly right. All right? Was that right? Was that correct? Was the king of Gath thinking correctly? Had David turned against Israel? Not really. You know what David did? He used Gath as a base of operations to what? Whack everyone but Israel. David was living a lie. David was not living the truth. He saw the inconsistency in an old guy named Saul. He saw a lack of integrity in an old guy named Saul. He saw a man who said, "Blessed be thou of the Lord." And David said, "I hear your words, but I see your life, and I'm getting out of here." Saul lacked integrity. Then what do you call what David was doing? What did David lack? The exact same thing. And I am seeing real time people of various ages by the bucketful rejecting the truth because the people representing it are either wrong in their actions or cranky in their life. And that's a false choice. It's not either or. Now David lacked integrity. Now David was confederate with a likable enemy in order to avoid an unlikable ally. Look, young person, go after evil with good. Do not hurt yourself trying to punish Saul, because the Philistines win when you do. Now David was living by sight, not by faith. In closing, let me encourage you to act in prayer, not despair, which did characterize David much of the time. Don't be naive and don't be impatient. David was anointed by God, but not yet king, but God will keep His word even if others do not, and live with purpose and principle and not excuses. Let me ask you a question. How clearly are you communicating the truth today? May God help us to hold the truth and to spread the truth by the things that we say and by the way that we live. Father, I want to thank You for the privilege of spending this time with my friends this morning. And Father, each of us perhaps could at some point find ourselves in either of these categories, but I pray that we would not allow others to trump the truth or misrepresent the truth to our own hurt. God, help us to be tenacious and honest and follow the truth wherever it may take us. And Father, help us to represent that truth in a way that honors You, I pray. Thank You for this wonderful day that we celebrate. In Jesus' name, amen.